Welcome to the Regulatory Transparency Project's fourth branch podcast series. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker.
Hello, and welcome to the Regulatory Transparency Project's fourth branch podcast, episode number 84. Today, we're joined by Dan Mornoff, Executive Director at the American Civil Rights Project, and Giancarlo Canaparo, Senior Legal Fellow at the Edwin Meese III Center for Legal and Judicial Studies at the Heritage Foundation, moderating a discussion on the changes of DEI policies under the new Trump administration is our moderator, Linda Chavez, who is the chairman for the Center for Equal Opportunity. Thank you all for joining us today. Thank you, Linda, Dan, Giancarlo. In order to get right to the discussion, I'll hand it off to our moderator, Linda. Thank you, Linda.
Thank you very much, Marie. And I was going to go into long descriptions of our two illustrious guests' careers, but I think instead we've got a limited amount of time that I want to jump right in and get to the executive orders. The new Trump administration has been very, very busy over its first couple of weeks. And one of the clear first priorities was to take on the issue of diversity, equity, and inclusion, and the way it has transformed civil rights and civil rights enforcement, particularly over the last 4 years during the Biden administration. There have been, I don't know, somewhere between 9 and 16 executive orders, depending on how you count them. Some have been issued as EO, some have been issues as a memoranda. We're obviously not going to be able to cover all of them. But I will cover just the initial action, which was ending radical and wasteful government DEI programs and preferencing. And I'm going to ask Dan if you could go into that.
Sure. That particular order, which was one of the ones entered on the first day, started out with the declaration that the Biden administration had forced illegal and immoral discrimination programs, and that ends today. That was the terminology used. And then it proceeds, and I think a lot of these are going to follow this pattern, after having a declaration of policy with a series of actually time-sensitive requirements for how the federal government's going to follow through on this. For this one, I think there are four that are worth particularly flagging as things that the order requires. The first of those is for the Office of Management and Budget, along with the Attorney General and the Office of Personnel Management, to coordinate termination of all discriminatory programs, to review all employment practices, union contracts, training policies, or programs across the entirety of the government. That one seemingly will be an ongoing structure for how the rest of this will unfold. A second one, that every agency within 60 days must terminate. I like this language because it actually captures the degree of discretion available to a president in an executive order, requires them all within 60 days to terminate to the maximum extent allowed by law, which I'm sure that others will explore, DEI or environmental justice, offices, positions, equity plans, initiatives, grants, contracts, and all DEI performance requirements for employees, contractors, or grantees. They're going to have a busy 2 months. Also, in those same 60 days, all agencies have to, backdated to November 4th, provide a list of all DEI and environmental justice positions, committees, programs, activities, budgets, and expenditures. Oh, also services. Also to list every effort undertaken to hide any of those things in the interim. That's why they backdated this to November 4th. All DEI training contractors and materials, all grantees funded to provide or advance DEI or environmental justice programs, services, and activities. Oh, and also to assess the cost profile of all of those programs and policies, presumptively so they can be folded into something like reconciliation. The last one I'll flag on this was, again, within 60 days, again, for all of the agencies. They are required to recommend actions to be taken to adhere to the policy stated, including expressly notice to Congress of unconstitutional things that they don't intend to do anymore, as well as policy changes, regulations to be pursued, and guidance to potentially be advanced in the future.
Well, that's pretty comprehensive. I should have said that also on the first day, they issued one sort of very broad, sweeping executive order, which was essentially a rescission of harmful executive orders and actions that had gone on in previous administrations. They are way too long to list. They cover a huge variety of programs, even Medicaid and the Affordable Care Act, migration on the border, rebuilding and enhancing programs to resettle refugees, promoting access to voting. There are just a ton of them. All of these, I should note, are available on the White House government site, where they do list all presidential executive orders, so people can go through them as well there. Giancarlo, I want to turn to you because one of the things that you wanted to talk a little bit about was the whole question of the changes that are going to be required in terms of government hiring. Mm-hmm. So maybe you can talk a bit about that.
Sure. So also on the first day, there was an order called Reforming Federal Hiring Processes and Restoring Merit to Government Services. And this order did two things. And actually, you know, the focus on race-based hiring is a small part of it. The order really takes issue with how inefficient the hiring process is. It takes ages to get hired. There's very little communication. So about two-thirds of the order is just sort of reforming and making more efficient the hiring process. But the beginning of the order focuses on DEI hiring preferences. The administration describes current hiring practices as broken and not focusing on merit, skill, or dedication to the Constitution, and says that instead current hiring practices reward people that express a commitment to equity and to gender ideology. So the Office of Management and Budget and the Office of Personnel Management are going to put together a new federal hiring plan, which will prioritize commitment to improving government efficiency and will prioritize hiring people who are passionate about the ideals of the American Republic and of upholding the rule of law and the Constitution. The plan will also forbid using preferences for race, sex, or religion in government hiring, and then again streamlines the back-end procedures around getting people hired.
All of those are obviously very sweeping. Let me play devil's advocate for a minute. This is a new administration coming in, elected by the people with the largest amount of votes. And most of the people who went to the polls had ideas in mind of what they wanted the administration to be doing. I think most analysts would agree that probably the issue of the economy was most on people's mind. Certainly DEI was a prominent issue in some minds. There were lots of commercials, for example, during the campaign that were critical, using then Vice President Kamala Harris's own words to talk about transgender issues, for example. But this is a lot of emphasis on DEI. Is it too much? Is this too much emphasis in the first few days of the new administration? Could it be described in any way as overkill? Dan?
I don't. I mean, I'm sure someone would describe it that way, but I think they would be wrong. I think that the administration has made fairly clear and had made clear before the election, so I don't think there's any bait and switch going on, that one of its real commitments was going to be restoring the government to its more traditional lane and getting government out of pushing what I would describe as illegal discrimination across the entire country, much less in its own actual programming. So the fact that the president has, among the earliest things he's chosen to do, is focusing on getting all of the government on board to actually stop discriminating and start enforcing civil rights laws that had been ignored or misinterpreted by his predecessor seems to me to be entirely appropriate.
Let me follow up with you and then you can add on to what Dan said. I'm going to play devil's advocate here. What about the notion that this is basically a way to control the way people speak, the way people think? Wouldn't it be possible to go through reams of regulations and programs and simply do an AI search and find the word diversity wherever it occurred, equity wherever it occurred, inclusion, simply change that? And in the process, might you, you know, get involved in getting rid of improper use of those terms? Biodiversity, for example, means something very different than the kind of diversity we talk about in hiring.
Yeah, sure. I'm not actually worried about that in this case. And the reason why is because in every of the orders that President Trump has issued on DEI and in his speeches, notably his Inauguration Day speech, he's been very clear that what he's targeting is conduct that violates the federal civil rights laws. He's not interested in lingo as such. He's not interested in finding the people who cite the buzzwords, but he's interested in, and took, this is a direct quote from the order we'll touch on next, I imagine, where he's going after DEI in the private sphere. But this is DEI-style discrimination that violates the civil rights laws, right? So if a company under these orders, if a company called something diversity, equity, and inclusion, but didn't do anything that was discriminatory, the orders don't give the government any impetus to go after that sort of thing. And frankly, the government is going to have its hands so full with actual discrimination, there's not going to be, I mean, it's not going to catch but a fraction of it, I gather, is my estimation. I'm not worried about wasting resources going after innocuous but maybe obnoxious lingo, right?
Let's also deal with the issue that may be in some people's mind, that this emphasis on DEI is really code for being anti-civil rights, and that this is a way to undercut our civil rights laws. So let's talk about that for a few minutes. Do these EOs in any way countermand Title VI, Title VII, any of our civil rights laws that guarantee both equal opportunity and non-discrimination, Dan?
No, and in fact, very much they are the opposite. They are, in fact, ordering and directing how the federal government should be much more actively enforcing its mandate under those statutes to root out illegal discrimination in the federal government and its various regulated communities.
Giancarlo, you want to?
Yeah. Let me just add, you know, Trump has taken a position which is emphatically not the libertarian position, which is that we should just leave the issue of discrimination to the marketplace. He has regularly and again routinely in every one of these orders re-emphasized that enforcing the Civil Rights Act is the priority. So it is a focus on discriminatory conduct that he wants to root out. It's very clear that he intends to do so. This is not a hands-off approach. This is really what the Biden administration did with respect to what you might call trendy discrimination, the sort that Harvard did in the case that got it to the Supreme Court, discriminating against Asians and whites on the ground that they are majority the phrase that often came up in the Harvard case is white adjacent groups. And those could be discriminated against. And Trump has said in each of these orders, the law applies to everyone equally, and we're going to be enforcing it.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about, let's divide it into two. Let's talk a little bit about the federal government and the personnel in the federal government, the offices in the federal government. Then let's talk a bit about the private sector. Which of you would like to take the federal government portion? Dan, Giancarlo? So these...
I'm not sure that these break down very easily that way.
Okay. Tell me why then.
Sure. Well, I mean, the first one that I'd mentioned, that was entirely, I guess, entirely about the, on the one hand, about what the federal government itself is doing. But of course, it's also talking about, you know, ending contracts with governmental vendors and suppliers, recipients of grants. That might be a good example of how this is primarily one, but it necessarily involves the other. I mean, I think the last estimate I saw when I'd gone digging was about 20% of the U.S. economy is directly governmental spending, without even considering the downstream multiples and effects that has, or frankly, even the fact that whether or not you're currently a government contractor, if you're running a business, you may intend to be a government contractor in the future and need to be able to show that you are and have been compliant with federal civil rights laws that are a condition for participation. So that above and beyond the 20%, the actual number of institutions that are influenced when you're talking about changes in governmental purchasing, it's much more than 20% of the economy. Even before we get into something like Title VII, which is literally the entire, or very nearly the entire world of employment. I mean, if you're employed by an employer who has fewer than, 15 employees, you're exempt. Right. There's that. That's true. But other than that, everyone, whether you're private, public, you're covered. So,
well, that is true. But let me tell you what I had in mind. Obviously, yeah, please. We talk about hiring processes. If you're the chief executive of the executive branch, you can call the shots to a certain degree within the law, within regulations, in how people are hired and appointed, whether they can keep their jobs. This administration may be pushing the envelope on this, but at least in previous administrations, it was in fact controlled by civil service law, et cetera. So obviously, if you issue an executive order having to do with hiring practices in the federal government, you've got direct control of that. I mean, you can get rid of things, change the emphasis on race preferences, for example, pretty easily. It's a little more difficult in terms of the private sector. It's not that Title VI might not cover some of these private sector employees if they're government contractors. It's not that Title VII doesn't apply to almost all of them if they have more than 15 employees. But in terms of implementing it, it's going to be somewhat different. It's going to, you know, it's going to be downstream. It's going to take a while. You know, you don't expect in our kind of free market economy that every HR director and every big company in America is going to take these executive orders and see them as directive from the CEO, for example. So it might take a while. So that's more what I was talking about. Giancarlo, do you have any feeling on that? Or
yeah, well, let me talk briefly about, you know, within the federal government, because that's, I think, there's less to unpack there, because as you said, Trump has a lot of authority. So one of the things he did is he said, if you are a DEI official within the government, you're going to be put on leave. The subtext being until we can, you know, figure out how to fire you. But he can do that. He can stop you from doing your job if your job is to impose DEI stuff on the government. He can sort of just do that through his secretaries and sub-officials at the stroke of a pen. And likewise, if you are a DEI professional and you're looking for a job in the federal government, you're not getting one for 4 years. And that's, again, just done with the stroke of a pen. But it's the relationship between the federal government and private parties where things get really interesting. And this is the subject of an order he issued on the second day called Ending Legal Discrimination and Restoring Merit-Based Opportunity. And it targets two groups, two sorts of entities. Like Dan said, on the one hand, there's the first group of entities, which are those covered by Title VI and VII of the Civil Rights Act. So Title VI applies to anyone who gets federal funds. Includes, you know, universities, for instance, almost all of them, with the exception of a small handful, federal grantees. And then you've got Title VII applies to, you know, any employer of any significant size. And they are not allowed to discriminate on the basis of race and ethnicity with respect to Title VI, race, ethnicity, and sex with respect to Title VII, and religion as well. Now what Trump has announced for those entities is that there's going to be really robust civil rights enforcement. Again, this is the language is, if you have any DEI policies that violate the civil rights laws, basically the federal government is looking for you and going to come after you. So that sort of raises the question, if you're the HR director, right, what of my DEI policies are going to be problematic? And I think I put together a short list of ones I think that the federal government's going to be coming after. These are things. Now bear in mind, let me just clear the air with respect to what exactly the text of Title VI and VII says. Title VI says no discrimination. Basically, sort of the fairest reading of it is really if you are taking federal funds, in none of the programs that you administer can you engage in race discrimination. And then Title VII says, with respect to hiring, firing, and any of the conditions of employment, no discrimination. So with that in mind, I think that means things like race and sex-based employee resource groups. These are sort of, groups within a company that the company supports, where if you look a certain way or are a certain sex, you're admitted to this group. Same with mentoring and promotion programs. These are conditions of employment. The same with color or race or sex segregated trainings. A lot of DEI trainings work this way. That's a condition of employment. And then this is an interesting one that I've noticed a lot of savvier companies do, especially like white shoe law firms. They do this in order, I think, to get around civil rights law. But what they do is they will give preferences in employment applications to people who go through race and sex-based fellowships, which are sorted, where the sorting is done by third parties. I don't think you can do that. I don't think, the Supreme Court is not going to let you do that. What cannot be done directly cannot be done indirectly. And then a third one, or rather, I think we're on number five now, but the last target for Civil Rights Act enforcement is companies that have targets. Like they say, we would like 25% of our employees to be a certain color. Well, the question is, how are you going to do that? If sort of normal human choice is not delivering that to you, how are you going to do that? So the only real clear answer is that you start picking on that basis. So I think those are the sorts of categories that are going to get the Trump administration's civil rights enforcers looking really hard under the Civil Rights Act.
Giancarlo, can I throw in another one, which I would hope would make that list too?
By all means.
Please. There's a widespread practice, and it's widespread because it was being pushed by the BlackRocks, State Streets, and Vanguards of the world, of tying the compensation of executives to their success in obtaining particular racial balances, usually racial, also sex, also gender, also national origin, the whole gamut. But tying their compensation to how successfully they attained DEI targets, whether that's in who works for them or who they've promoted or who they're contracting with as third parties, all of which is illegal. But, I would hope the federal government is going to be focused on a lot of those kinds of policies as well, rooting them out and extinguishing them.
Dan, you say all of those are illegal. I would agree with you on that. But do we have precedent in the courts that have backed up that interpretation?
Sure. The short answer is yes. The best case that's out there for this is a Fifth Circuit case called Xerox. I'm trying to remember. I don't remember the rest of the name of it, honestly. It's been a little while. Where what it actually held under Title VII was that if you have a system that rewards your executives for racially balancing and someone complains that, yeah, in fact, that is a violation of Title VII. So that one's probably the squarest on point for the executive compensation point.
And do you think that this is going to spur lots of new lawsuits and that it will, in fact, be litigated and maybe make it all the way to the Supreme Court, as we saw in the case of the universities, where we finally got a decision a couple of years ago that that did shut down racial preferences or at least we think it did. We're still monitoring whether that's the case.
Yeah. The short answer is that, yes, I would expect that eventually the plaintiff's bar, because it is really interested in money, even more interested in money than it is in faddish discrimination, is going to follow where case law points it, or maybe more to the point, follow where the EEOC points it in telling them, no, we really do agree that this is illegal. We're bringing big case X against whomever. You might want to bring the same case also. Eventually, those incentives are going to move action.
Yeah, I think you may also see, you know, over time, a shift in the traditional divide where, you know, plaintiffs' lawyers are almost always Democrats or progressives, right? Because now there's an enormous incentive if you are a conservative, civil rights minded person to just start doing some plaintiffs litigation. Actually, a friend of mine, the moment this EO dropped, called me and said, "You want to quit your job and start a plaintiffs firm with me?" And I said, "No, but go forth and make a killing, because you know, the opportunity is there right now."
Let me again try to put on my devil's advocate hat and look at this. When we think of civil rights enforcement, you know, since the 1964 Act, the kind of discrimination that was being rooted out, while yes, it was colorblind, it was supposed to be colorblind. You were basically not supposed to use race to make a decision about who to hire, who to promote, what to pay them. But it was seen, at least initially, as rectifying wrongs that had been committed against Black Americans, Latinos, and others. Most of these orders seem to be aimed at trying to stop what, in the old parlance, we would call reverse discrimination, where you're discriminating against whites in favor of Blacks, Latinos, and others. What is that going to mean for the old-fashioned civil rights laws? I'm assuming that neither of you believe that we've crossed into the promised land and that everyone's heart is pure and that there is absolutely no discrimination against Blacks or Latinos. There clearly still is. And so what's it going to mean in terms of enforcement of those laws?
I'm quite sure that people will continue to bring claims, valid claims, also invalid claims. There are a lot of bad discrimination claims that are brought, and I assume that will continue. But there are also a lot of good ones that are brought, and I assume that those will continue. The plaintiff's bar is not going to stop bringing those either. The whole point here is that the law still applies in all of the situations you're talking about. It's just that the administration is acknowledging that when Congress wrote our non-discrimination laws, it wrote non-discrimination laws. And non-discrimination laws protect everyone against discrimination. So in fact, when you systematically ignore, as the last administration did, the large-scale discrimination by very large companies, also smaller, but you know, very large corporations, in the name of rectifying societal discrimination, I think was the term that was used by the Supreme Court for decades, that's never legitimate. You can't actually do that. You can engage in legally, and you have been able to for decades, you can legally discriminate in order to fix the harms caused by your own recent history of discriminating in a traditionally segregated part of your workforce.
Right.
That's
and actually has been. Right. Actual victims of discrimination can be made whole. So even if correct. That means, you know, a white got the job that should have gone to a better qualified Black applicant, and, you know, you've got to now give it to the Black applicant, and that means the white may be out of a job. You can do that.
Right. Right. But you have to do that. And, you know, so if you're not doing that, and instead, like, I'll pick on Dropbox. Dropbox had a published policy that it was going to, it wanted its workforce to reflect the diversity of the world in all its dimensions. and they didn't peg it to the demography of the United States, which would have been irrelevant because it you know, actually you have to, in Title VII world, care about who is qualified and interested in taking your job. But they didn't even do that. I mean, they're hypothetically pegging this to world population. By the way, the one group they're most clearly discriminating against is what they score as Asians. By the way, if you're actually trying to peg your workforce to the demography of the world, more of the world's population lives in East Asia, South Asia, and Southeast Asia than outside of it. And yet that's the group that is both the only one underrepresented and the one they were discriminating against. This can't be right.
That's fascinating. Could you just say just a minute, Giancarlo, you wrote a wonderful paper about the civil rights laws. Mm-hmm. And can you just sort of encapsulate in a minute or so what you believe in terms of the civil rights laws and their proper enforcement?
Yeah, let me launch into that by referencing, you know, the phrase you pulled up a moment ago, reverse discrimination. And the simple fact of the matter is there's no such thing, because what the civil rights law targets by its plain terms and by the manifest intent of the people who wrote it and signed it is that what it's targeting is the act of treating somebody differently on an arbitrary basis, which race is. It's the act, it's that act of choice, which is immoral. It's not that, it has nothing to do actually with the color of a person's skin that the law is targeting, right? If I fired an employee because I sincerely thought that he was Martian, even though Martians are not a protected class, the act that I have done in choosing to treat him differently on an irrelevant basis is immoral. And that's what the law is targeting. And so the law is trying to teach people not to make that arbitrary and immoral choice. And it doesn't matter what the color of the person's skin is. So when you say, you know, what does this mean for our old understanding of civil rights law? It means we're returning to an old understanding of the civil rights law, that the law is neutral, that justice is blind, that everyone is treated equally, and that you don't have the liberty to discriminate against somebody on an arbitrary basis.
We've talked a lot about race in this first half hour, but some of these executive orders, some of the most important ones, I think, had to do with sex, or as progressives would like to call it, gender. But I think we've now reverted back to calling sex, sex. Dan, you want to talk about that for a minute?
Yeah, one of the, again, first day orders, this one was, its full title was Defending Women from Gender Ideology, Extremism, and Restoring Biological Truth. And I think you can probably tell an awful lot of its content just from that title. Again, it follows the same structure of having a policy statement, and after the policy statement, having a whole laundry list of things that will require the agencies going forward. For accuracy, here's what the policy portion of this was. We will be basing federal policy on truth is critical to scientific inquiry, public safety, morale, and trust in government. So the federal government, the president, now recognizes the immutable biological reality of sex. Women are biologically female and men are biologically male. It recognizes there are two sexes, male and female, not changeable, and are grounded in fundamental, incontrovertible reality, and states that the executive branch will enforce all sex protective laws to promote this reality. There's a lot of commentary below as to how they're going to achieve that. I can roll through that if you want. We cannot. There are like 11 action items. But the commitment here that the president has made for the government, whether through guidance, whether through regulation, and it does specify in a few places where regulatory changes will be necessary, across the board, is to disassociate the federal government from what it defines as gender identity and gender ideology, and to return, as by the way, in the Title IX sphere, where there was just this extensive fight unfolding across the nation's courts, which seems to have now ended. I think in, what, 8 for 8 courts of appeals, as far as we got rulings, and the Supreme Court, we got rulings that, no, actually, Title IX is about sex, not about gender, or something approximating that, whether or not it's really fair to say the Supreme Court got quite that far. But the president, in accordance with all of that, is going back to saying we are going to enforce Title IX and Title VII and all of the other non-discrimination laws that are relevant, but we're going to do them for sex, focusing on sex, not on this other concept, which is entirely, what was the phrase they used? Entirely, fully internal and subjective as a sense of self.
It's amorphous, right? It really is. It's very difficult to define gender. And there are disagreements even among progressives about how many genders there are. In particular, when you're writing laws, it seems it's very difficult. If it's all in the mind, not of the beholder even, but of the initiator, I guess, it's very difficult. So there were also some executive orders, or at least one, having to do with indoctrination of kids in K through 12. And wonder if either of you would like to weigh in on that.
I bet we really don't have time to do so in any depth, but there was this K through 12 order. There's also one about anti-Semitism. There are a whole slew of them that are issue specific to the military, which is interesting because they tend to overlap with the ones we've already discussed. And I'm not entirely sure why the president felt it necessary to specifically say it for the military, but, you know, more power to you.
Yeah. In the last few months, I realized I never got to the second point about the government contractors in the EO. Let me just briefly summarize what that does. So it ended an order from Lyndon B. Johnson, which established that government contractors need to have affirmative action plans. Now, at the time, that meant something very different than it means today. That just meant you need to show why you're not discriminating. Over time, the federal government morphed that into you need to show preferences and meet quotas, et cetera, et cetera. So that's gone. And then this is where things get really interesting. New federal contracts and grants will now include two provisions which say, A, we promise federal government that we are not discriminating in violation of the civil rights laws, and we promise that we have no DEI policies that violate the civil rights laws. Now, why you would add a term like that to federal contracts and grants is because it makes those contracts and grants, it makes that term subject to the FCA, the False Claims Act, which means that you can be sued if the federal government finds out that actually you do have discriminatory DEI plans. The federal government can sue you. Private parties representing the federal government can sue you and get part of the government's recovery. It's called QI-TAM actions. And you're, you know, you can be subject to non-payment on your contracts. So that really ups the stakes for anyone doing business with the federal government.
Those aren't just damages of like disgorge the money you were paid. It's triple plus a statutory fine for every individual transaction they paid based on it. I think that statutory fine is somewhere between $5,000 and $10,000.
Yeah, so, plus you get costs and fees.
Yeah, wow. So if you're talking about something like a suit that was brought, let's say a phone company had a discriminatory DEI program, you've seen a phone bill. You've seen every line item on that. Every line item on that is getting tripled, and every line item on that is carrying a $5,000 to $10,000 fine as a separate transaction. Those numbers will be astronomical.
I don't know, Giancarlo. Maybe that friend of yours who called and wanted to know. That might have been good advice to take. So there's a lot of money to be made here. But, you know, 11246, the history of that is very interesting. And having been gone from the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights as the staff director over to the White House during the Reagan years, there was a working group put together during President Reagan's term to discuss not rescinding 11246, but rewriting it to make it clear clear that giving preferences on the basis of race was not permitted. It died, unfortunately. It was considered controversial and it died. But when you're talking about employers, particularly anybody who does any kind of contracting with the government, I have sat on several boards, corporate boards, and I will tell you that visits from the Office of Federal Contract Compliance Programs at the Department of Labor are anticipated with fear and loathing in many companies, because they do go in and can make life very difficult. And it has gone way beyond simply encouraging people to take affirmative steps to recruit people on a colorblind basis, but to give opportunity to people who might have been neglected in the past. It's gone way beyond that to actually putting in place numerical goals and timetables, which end up operating like quotas. So I think that that is going to be very interesting. And I want to ask either one of you if you know the answer. Since we now have this executive order rescinding 11246, is that going to mean that the Office of Federal Contract Compliance Programs has any legal authority to continue to do the work that it's been doing?
I know that this order that took out 11246 also assigns tasks to OFCCP. So seemingly they intend for it to still exist. One interesting detail is that 11246 is the order that created the OFCCP. And this order doesn't actually say anything granting it continued viability. I haven't really seen this discussed, and I certainly don't know the answer. But I think it's a fascinating question whether that means that the office no longer exists at all. You know, one of the things that DOGE was talking about right at the outset was whether whether there's a legal distinction between agencies of the government whose authorization by Congress has expired and those that haven't. Like, regardless of what you think about whether the president has the constitutional authority to impound funds for authorized agencies that have been appropriated money, you might have a very different answer where the agency has no legal existence and it's just still churning along because Congress, you know, wrote a check to something that's hypothetically defunct. Whatever the answer is to that, I think that it might be an interesting one. It has to be more dramatic here, where there is no authorizing statute at all. It exists only because of an executive order, and an executive order that has been revoked. Like, I don't know the answer. I'm not sure we'll ever find out the answer. It might be fascinating when a company gets that call telling it has an audit for, I guess, the new requirements of what OFCCP is going to be policing. If they simply said, "We're not going to comply because you're not a thing." I don't know why I'd want to make that call for them as a lawyer, much less an officer or director. You might have some very hefty penalties that kick in, but if you did, you might in fact win.
Yeah. Giancarlo, anything you want to add on that? Or
no, that's I defer to Dan's summary on that.
Great. Well, we only have a couple of minutes left, and so I'm going to give each of you the chance to just briefly sum up what you think the effect of these executive orders is going to be. Is this as much an effort to change the culture as it is to change practice? I'll start with you, Giancarlo.
Yeah, to answer your question directly, I think with respect to is this an attempt to shift the culture? Yes, and I hope it is, because although I'm a lawyer, I actually have a pretty dim view of the raw power of the law is. And I think if anything, particularly the Biden administration and the way that they just refuse to enforce the civil rights laws neutrally and allowed a culture of disobedience to the civil rights laws to permeate corporate America, it just goes to show that having good laws on the books isn't enough. You need a culture that believes in them and that's willing to enforce them. So I hope so. I hope it does shift the culture. And I hope that I think the orders alone are not going to be enough. There's going to need to be a robust enforcement and a continuing public education campaign.
Let me just follow up with you, Dan, ask you a slightly different question, and that is, do you think we're going to see any sort of massive resistance, either legal challenges, challenging whether or not these executive orders are, you know, within the scope of the president's right, or just other forms of resistance?
Sure. And I'll come back to the last thing that Giancarlo had actually said as well in answering this. I think these executive orders, they are a great list of things for the agencies to do, but they're just a list. The things haven't been done yet. You're totally right. We are going to see massive resistance. There are already lawsuits that have been filed challenging the orders. They're mostly going to lose. They're going to lose because the orders don't do anything. The orders, because they were actually well written this time, order agencies to do things. When the agencies do things, we're going to have a whole nother round of lawsuits, because there will be affected parties who will have standing to be able to complain about them. But right now, people are just mouthing off, and I don't expect the cases filed now to be very material. But we are going to have to fight inch by inch through all of the institutions across all of the culture as we weed this out. Basically, we're going to have to engage in the legal system's equivalent of house-to-house urban combat to take out an embedded system. So we'll have to do that. And I guess I'd sum it up this way. You might have found the world's best cheesecake recipe, but you can't eat a recipe. You actually need to bake it. So where we are right now is that the agencies are baking, and they've got a lot of baking to do, and we're going to have to fight to preserve the whole baking process, and then to defend the cakes. And then we're going to have to go a whole lot further, because there are a whole lot of things that, while these are a great list and I'm very happy that they exist, there is a lot more that is going to need to be done. And a lot of it's going to have to involve Congress as well, because there are things that are wrong with our laws that we really do need to get right in ways that the president almost surely cannot fix on his own.
Well, thank you both very much. I think this has been a very enlightening and broad conversation. And obviously, it's not going to be the last conversation on this topic, because as Dan has suggested, it is going to be what these executive orders essentially comprise as a kind of playbook. But we're going to have to see it on the field, and we're going to have to see what ends up happening. Thank you both very much, Giancarlo Canapero and Dan Morinoff. Thank you very much for being our guests today.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
On behalf of the Federal Society's Regulatory Transparency Project, thanks for tuning in to the Fourth Branch Podcast. To catch every new episode when it's released, you can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Spreaker. For the latest from RTP, please visit our website at regproject.org. That's regproject.org.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.